Good evening and welcome to City Vision. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Yesterday, as George Floyd was laid to rest in Houston, protests against the police brutality that killed Floyd continued across the country. The massive and largely peaceful outpouring of outrage and grief in the Bay Area, nationwide, and across the world have encouraged protesters, and many believe that an inflection point has been reached. 50 years ago, that same hope flickered when President Lyndon B. Johnson convened the bipartisan National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders to study the root causes for the civil unrest that gripped the country in the summer of 1967. Later this hour, we'll talk about the Kerner Report, which concluded that, quote, our nation is moving towards two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal, close quote, and examine why its recommendations were not adopted and how the same people who had called for the report ultimately chose to ignore it. But first, following more than 3 months of sheltering in place, the Bay Area is slowly emerging from quarantine against the backdrop of daily protest rallies for racial justice. What is the medical world saying about the safety of joining a political protest? And what does the summer look like for us under the veil of COVID-19? I'm welcome back to the show, Peter Chin Hong from UCSF. Welcome, Peter.
Hey, Pache.
And I'm also welcoming back Erin Alday, health reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Welcome, Erin.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
All right. Well, Dr. Peter Chin Hong, I wanted to start with you. You were quoted in the LA Times yesterday saying that racism is a public health crisis, and you've edited and signed a petition supporting the marchers. Tell us why you joined that effort.
Well, as you pointed out, Joseph, the idea that race is inextricably linked to health outcomes was really the motivation behind it. And that these health outcomes, when you actually put them in numbers, dwarfs any negative effects of COVID, even though COVID is in everyone's minds. But when you think of the legacy of racism and its impact on the health of our community and the disparities that we see in cardiovascular disease, pulmonary disease, even cancer, morbidity and mortality, not to talk about the effects of violence on days lost from work and from deaths, you can see that racism is very much has an impact on health. And if you want to address racism, you need to have your voice heard.
So there is a long history of disparities research in medicine. Do you see this petition and actions like it signaling a change, a politicization of the medical establishment, or doctors one by one, so to speak, who are just coming together?
Well, I think it's giving people more courage in terms of health professionals to really stand on their platform and not just be passive supporters, but actually use their medical knowledge or their scientific knowledge to try to convince people maybe on the fence or beyond that, to actually galvanize movements and to enact change in laws like what we recently did in Portland.
So your petition also includes tips not only for how marchers can stay safe, but also includes recommendations to public safety personnel on how to keep marchers safe. Why don't you run through those for us?
So let's think about two populations. There's a population of people who have COVID, but they may not have any symptoms or have very mild symptoms, which we know could be a substantial proportion of transmissions. All of a sudden, they're sprayed with tear gas and they begin to cough, which is what tear gas is designed to do. So that coughing really weaponizes that person to become an efficient transmitter of COVID. Other than that, they're also taking off their mask because it's soaked in an irritant, able to transmit more. They're shouting and screaming, which can aerosolize these droplets, which otherwise would be heavy, and they can transmit it. Now, let's take about the other population of people who don't have COVID. They're sprayed. They take off their mask if they're wearing one. They're rubbing their eyes and their nose and their mouth. And who knows where those hands have been, because you can't really wash them easily when you're on the field. And apart from that, you irritate and inflame that first line of defense in the mucosa, which keeps the evil humors out of our system. And we know that military recruits, when they are sprayed with pepper spray or with tear gas, they actually have a 2.5 times increased risk of respiratory viruses, again, from disrupting that barrier. So for both those populations, we think of them both as more efficient transmitters, as both and also as efficient, more efficient receptacles for getting infected.
So you're saying that police should change their tactics in trying to control crowds. And what can marchers and protesters do to protect themselves?
So I think, first of all, wearing masks is probably the most important thing. The second thing is to carry backups and also have a group of allies who man a table, just like you have a table in a marathon and people keep water. You have a COVID table with not just water, but extra masks, hand sanitizers. You can go back and forth because I know everyone wants to have their voice heard. Those are things that, and then you stay in a bubble. So the other thing that we introduced with this concept of cohorting, where you kind of stay in the same group, if at all possible, that makes it easier in terms of risk, but also in terms of contact tracing, which might be a little bit harder since people may have to give up addresses and names of people they've been in touch with if they turn positive.
So how would you respond to Dr. Anthony Fauci's comments this morning on Good Morning America when not having such a positive view towards protesting from the sense of risk reduction or harm reduction, saying that masks are important but not enough, and it's really physical distancing that has to go along with masks to decrease the risk of spread protesters. How do you respond to his take on this?
Well, I think my thinking about social distancing has evolved over the last months. Of course, social distance plus mask is better than, you know, either one alone. But if you look at communities where universal masking is in place, for example, Hong Kong, Taiwan, South Korea, you look at pictures, these people are crossing the street in droves, yet their community prevalence isn't that high. So actually, as we look at the evidence and the scientific data, and you can ask George Rutherford, for example, who's looked at this at UCSF, masking is actually much more important than social distancing. And it makes sense. You know, you're shouting at someone, you're even talking, you're in choir practice in LA. All of these have been associated with transmissions in the absence of masks.
So I want to shift gears to talking about reopening of the economy and getting life back on track to somewhat of a sense of normalcy with you, Aaron Alday. In your story in the Chronicle, you quote experts as saying that the openings are happening too much and too soon, while Governor Gavin Newsom is saying that he will not roll back the timeline for reopening our economy. So as summer progresses and people get weary of sheltering in place, what are public health officials saying will happen? And how can we keep the tide from turning and the curve from surging?
Right. So the reopening process is definitely, it's rolling forward, basically. It's one of those things that kind of once you get started, it builds a little momentum, and it's really hard to rein it in once you start kind of giving people parts of their life back and giving them sort of some privileges and reopening. That's part of the reason why the Bay Area counties have still been more conservative than the rest of the state, is they've been very wary of this idea of reopening and the potential for cases to pick up and then feeling like they need to shut things down again. But even here in the Bay Area, you know, we're seeing this sort of pressure to reopen things. And there certainly are some folks who are concerned. Even some of the health officers who are moving forward have concerns that, you know, we're going to see upticks in cases, that it's going to be a real challenge ahead of us to keep these cases from really picking up too far too fast. And, you know, forcing us to need probably not to go back into a full down shelter in place situation again. We hope not. But to, you know, hunker down some more, to maybe kind of close off some of the things that we've opened or slow things down. You know, places like Alameda County have definitely taken their time. They've sort of looked at the numbers and decided to, you know, give more of a cushion between reopening phases. We've seen that happen in Sonoma County too, a couple of places that see upticks and have taken a cautious route there. But meanwhile, you know, other parts of the state are moving on pretty quickly. Los Angeles is reopening pretty fast. And I think that's what has people a little bit nervous, both in terms of, you know, each of these counties is not an island. So whatever happens in other parts of the state is going to factor into our situation here in the Bay Area. But also, again, that political pressure, it gets, the more things open up in other parts of the state, the harder it is for public health officials to kind of keep telling our local communities that that we're not ready yet. You keep kind of seeing other people, you know, going and getting their hair done and going to movies and getting to kind of live their lives. And we're still locked down. That gets, it's a harder pill to swallow when you have more and more of the state opening up. So I think that that's kind of where we're at. And then, you know, everybody sort of expects that as we roll back more of these restrictions, that we're going to see upticks in cases. It's just a matter of how much and how good a job we're doing with the testing and contact tracing at keeping those case counts kind of under control of managing them.
And staying with you, Erin, and the impact perhaps on a number of new cases due to the protests of the last several weeks, how are public health officials preparing for a possible surge?
Well, there definitely is concern that there will be an uptick in cases. Pretty much everybody I talk to says that. I will say in the Bay Area, well, first of all, we probably won't see those cases for another week or two at least. We might start seeing here and there a couple of people testing positive, but we won't really see it reflected in the numbers for another couple of weeks. The surge is the case increases that we're seeing right now. They're kind of tying back to Memorial Day a couple of weeks ago. So we're on the sort of 2 week cycle where it takes about that long for these issues to show up. So they're expecting to see that there will be an increase in numbers. It's going to be really challenging to connect them specifically to the protests because, you know, that the protests have been going on, you know, day after day after day. It's going to be hard to like interview one person and say, you know, were you infected at this protest? Who else find that you have been in contact with this protest? So doing that kind of work is going to be hard to pin it down. But a lot of the public health folks I talked to say the same thing that Peter said, which is these protests are vital. They're so important to who we are. They're part of public health. And so they're kind of these health officers are just prepared to, when the cases do pick up, assuming that they do, they'll handle it. They will, you know, respond to it. They'll get people tested as best they can. They're encouraging protesters to get tested a few days to a week after they attend these protests and to get their results and to isolate or quarantine themselves as necessary. So, you know, they're just planning to be very proactive in responding to it and try to keep the case counts, you know, as under control as they can.
So, Peter, you were just mentioning a few moments ago that wearing a mask is more important, perhaps, than social distancing. So when you think about the potential surge in cases from protests, how do you balance this out? How do you imagine that this may play out? If people were masked for the most part, are we okay, even if they weren't physically distancing themselves? But then, of course, on the other hand, it's going to be hard, as you mentioned, to do contact tracing of any new cases of people who may have been infected during a protest. So how do you make sense of all of that?
Well, I think it will depend on a couple of things. It depends on how many people are actually wearing masks, including law enforcement. So the more people that wear them, the better. Hopefully these masks have good integrity and they're not torn. People don't rip them off. People don't get sprayed. And then also depends on the prevalence in the community. So protesting in the Bay Area is probably going to be different from protesting in Arizona, although they probably won't protest that much in some places there, or protesting in other cities where there's a higher prevalence, because the risk of going in that setting is going to be higher based on your local epidemiology. But also it's outdoors, so it's better than an indoor setting when we think about congregate settings like nursing homes and prisons, et cetera.
And Erin, the original plan of the six Bay Area counties was to move in lockstep, and that's no longer the case. What kinds of challenges are coming up now that different counties within the Bay Area are moving at different rates?
I think there are a few challenges there. One is sort of that political pressure, that economic pressure I was talking about. You know, even between in the East Bay Alameda County and Contra Costa County, and note that there isn't any sort of disagreement. I don't think there's no bad blood between those counties. They communicate all the time, but you know, they will express in Alameda County going slower. It's a lot. It gets increasingly hard for them to tell their businesses and their residents why they're locked down when something that is literally across the street is opening up because it's in a different county. So that's certainly is one issue. You know, another issue is just, this kind of fatigue that people have. You know what I mean? It's like you see everybody kind of out and about and doing their own thing. And it kind of wears on people. And there's also a lot of confusion. I mean, it was really easy to say everywhere in the Bay Area is shelter in place. So everybody knows what they're supposed to do. It was kind of one uniform message. That's fine. Now it's really, really kind of challenging, I think, for people to know exactly what's allowed and what's not allowed in their own community. I mean, I am, you know, as on top of this as somebody can be, and I get confused all the time. And I know that people really struggle. Am I allowed to go to a restaurant in my county? Can I go to the pool? And you can look up some of that stuff online, but it can get really confusing and it can get really kind of frustrating for people. So I think those are two of the main things, is sort of this communication and this messaging have been a problem. And then kind of that pressure that it puts on these health officers to respond.
And let's say protesters do want to get tested. Is it enough to go to their healthcare provider or one of these city test sites and say, I was in a protest, I'm following recommendations to get tested?
That's a really good question. There are definitely some testing sites that have opened, at least in San Francisco, and I believe San Mateo County. I think most of the counties at this point have at least one testing site. If you go on their website, on their county public health websites, they should say that are specifically open for protesters. They're encouraging protesters to get tested, telling them to come down. If you call or show up even and say, I've been at a protest and I want to get tested, they will test you. I think for providers, it really depends a lot. I worked on a story just today about Santa Clara County is putting pressure on its private providers, like it's Kaiser and Sutter, to kind of ramp up their testing and do more testing of their own members. So at this point, like today, I don't know that I could go to, you know, my healthcare provider and say, I was at a protest, I really want to get tested. A lot of the private providers aren't yet doing that kind of on-demand testing yet, but there is that pressure kind of on them. So it may, you know, the answer today may actually be a different answer tomorrow. It certainly is worth asking. If you have insurance, if you're with Kaiser or something, it's worth calling and asking, can I get a test if I was at a protest? And if they won't do it, then your county surely will, because they do actively want people to get tested.
And Peter, the WHO has kind of been all over the place in advising whether asymptomatic individuals can transmit the virus. What do you make of that? And also, what do you advise people who are asymptomatic? Should they get tested? Now, perhaps if they were in a protest, maybe you would suggest that they should more likely get tested? Or do you draw lines and certain people should get tested who are asymptomatic and other not?
Yeah, so that's a great question. First of all, let's talk about the WHO. Of course, this is like the second major WHO drama during COVID. The first, of course, was when they said ibuprofen was bad, and then everybody went out and bought Tylenol except me, because I like ibuprofen. But then the second thing when they, and then they retracted it the next day, the second thing when they a couple of days ago said that asymptomatic transmission wasn't a thing. But of course, all the scientists were in uproar, and then they changed and moderated their tune. Of course, there's a lot of good basic science showing that there's actually a lot of viral load is actually higher in the 2 days before symptoms. And we have many stories or anecdotes. There just isn't a lot of great clinical studies showing defined transmissions through asymptomatic routes. But it makes sense to me, given what we know about the biology of COVID-19. And in terms of like advising people who are asymptomatic, right now, I think we have a tiered approach. So certainly people getting something in a high-risk situation, for example, in healthcare, we're screening all asymptomatic people going in for surgery right now. So I think in those settings, for sure, we are doing asymptomatic screening. But the rest of the population, I think as we ramp up testing, we can pull like an Iceland or South Korea and maybe test more people. Certainly, when learners are coming to UCSF, like new residents and fellows, they're going to be tested as well.
And Aaron Alday, if you, in 30 seconds, could just give us updates about what school openings will look like in August.
Oh, well, that's a big topic. I think that's something they're working out. It's going to require such a lot of work by the schools to limit the capacity, to kind of cut the classrooms figure out, you know, who will get to go to class, who will be doing the online, the distance learning still, who's going to be wearing masks, how do you feed the kids, how do you send them to recess. I know that there's a lot of pressure on the schools, and they're really worried about having the money to afford all these changes. So honestly, I think that is still a work in progress. We've had a lot of guidance on what classrooms might look like in the fall, but there's not really a lot of clarity on how that's actually going to play out at this point.
Well, at least we have 2 months to fret over that. Well,
yes.
Once again, I want to thank Aaron Alday of the San Francisco Chronicle and Dr. Peter Chin Hong of UCSF for giving us a update on COVID in the Bay Area and around the world. And we look forward to you joining us again next Wednesday.
Always a pleasure, Apache and Aaron.
Thanks, Peter.
Bye.
And next up, we'll be talking to a panel of experts about the Kerner Commission, a committee convened by President Lyndon Johnson in 1967 to study the root causes of civil unrest. Stay with us. Welcome back to City Visions. I'm Joseph Pache. Next, we turn to the lessons we can learn from the 1968 Kerner Report, which was meant to offer a blueprint towards dismantling systemic racism. It pointed to the root causes of civil unrest: white racism, police brutality, economic inequality, and more. But instead of galvanizing forces for change, it was effectively shelled by the very people who called for the commission. Today, as protesters and activists seek change, what lessons can we learn from the missed opportunities presented in the Kerner Report? And can it point us towards a direction of more racial justice and equity in our country? To learn more about this, I'm fortunate to be joined by Sandra Susan Smith, former professor and chair of the sociology department at UC Berkeley, and the incoming Daniel and Florence Guggenheim professor of criminal justice at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Welcome, Sandra. Your mic is muted. There okay. You are. Welcome, you Sandra.
Hey, thank you very much. Good to be here.
Also, delighted to be joined by John A. Powell, professor of law, African American studies, and ethnic studies at UC Berkeley, and director of the Other and Belonging Institute.
Nice to be here.
And finally, we're joined by Alan Curtis, president and CEO of the Eisenhower Foundation and co-author of the book, Healing Our Society, Investing in America 50 Years After the Kerner Report. And thanks, Alan, for staying up late. I understand you're calling from the East Coast.
Joseph, glad to join you today.
And of course, we want to invite you, our listeners, to join this critical conversation. You can join our conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send an email to cityvisions@kalw.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionskalw. So, Alan Curtis, I wanted to start with you. When it was published in 1968, the Kerner Report was a bombshell. It was republished by the New York Times. It was a bestseller and widely lauded as a way forward on systemic racial injustice. And no one expected that the people who were assembled on that commission would have come forward with the insights and the recommendations that they made. But today, unfortunately, few people have even heard about it or recall its contents. So let's start with a brief history lesson. What was the Kerner Commission and what did it recommend?
The Kerner Commission was formed by President Johnson. The majority of its members were privileged white men of the establishment. They were to look at the disturbances, the protests in over 150 cities that occurred in the 1960s. They reached the conclusion that America was heading towards two societies, black and white, separate and unequal. They focused on white racism. The president at the time thought that the recommendations of the Kerner Commission were pressing against his Great Society program, and so he stepped away from accepting those recommendations, and it was also complicated by the protests during the Vietnam War. after the election in 1968, which Richard Nixon won, there was no real interest in the new administration for implementing the recommendations. But essentially, back then, the Kerner Commission said, we've not made progress in reducing poverty, inequality, and racial injustice. 50 years later, we still haven't made much progress in reducing poverty, inequality, and racial injustice. And in many, many ways, we've actually gone backwards.
And the report included actionable steps that the government could take and said things like, we need to really invest here and it needs to be sustained and we may need to raise taxes. And this was from a bipartisan commission.
It was bipartisan. But again, most of the commissioners were privileged white men. So that made it all the more remarkable. There were two African-American members on the commission, but the rest were white.
And in the book that I mentioned in my intro and in a report published by you about the Kerner Commission 50 years later, you paint a pretty bleak picture of where we have traveled in the last 50 years when it comes to racial inequality in this country.
You're right. And we really just talk about trends and evidence and will. Since the Kerner Commission, for example, deep poverty has increased. Income and wealth inequality have increased. Public school segregation has increased. Mass incarceration of people of color really is the present iteration of slavery and Jim Crow. So those are examples of many negative trends, even though, of course, we've had the first African-American president and there's been progress in expanding the middle class among African-Americans and the Latinx population. So there are a lot of negatives, but the irony is we really developed and identified a lot of evidence on what works to reduce poverty, inequality, and racial injustice. Yet we haven't been able to scale up because we still don't have what the Kerner Commission called new will to among the American people. And Dr. King endorsed the Kerner Commission in February of 1968 and focused on new will through what was a coalition for economic justice that Dr. King wanted to have embrace all races and most classes. Once he was assassinated, that notion of an economic justice coalition and new will really evaporated, and we're still waiting for that to happen.
So, John Powell, I wanted to turn to you next around this question of will. A lot of people have been pinning hopes on the ongoing protests some 2 weeks after George Floyd's death at the hands of police in Minneapolis. Do you see a new will that is growing and that could be sustained?
Well, it's definitely growing. There's no doubt about it. We have at the height of the uprisings and demonstrations following Michael Brown's killing in Ferguson, the support among the American people peaked out at about 40%. In the current climate, the killing of George Floyd by police Derek. Right now, the support for the demonstrations at about 74%. So that's huge, a 34% increase. It means the vast majority of Americans actually see a need to address racial problems, including a significant number of Republicans. That's almost, in recent times, that's unprecedented. The Kerner Commission was a bipartisan commission, but the American people as a people were not behind it. Most people forget that even at the time of King's death, he was not that popular. So I do see a new energy, a new commitment, a new understanding, and people are using terms like white supremacy and anti-Black racism, where only 2 years ago, you couldn't use those terms in mainstream America without being vilified. You use it in progressive racial justice communities. And the level of demonstrations are unprecedented. In Kerner Commission, they said there were 150 demonstrations or uprisings or rebellions in 1967. I just looked today before the radio program, 750 demonstrations in the United States alone. Every major city, every state in rural America. And it's much more multiracial, much more multi-sector, where you have the former Secretary of Defense, where you have ambassadors, current ambassadors, not previous ambassadors, I mean ambassadors appointed by Trump, where you have businesses, tech industry, almost uniformly come out in favor of Black Lives Matter. And at the same time, the heart of it is young Black activists with white, Latino, Asian colleagues demonstrating for going on 3 weeks. At the same time, you see a global phenomenon. So demonstrations all around the world. So there's a new energy and a new understanding. Whether this will translate into new programs, the answer is more careful. You're seeing some things already. You're seeing the University of Minnesota stepping away from its contract with police. You see Los Angeles cutting the police budget by between $100 million and $150 million out of $3 billion budget. You see states and cities passing laws in terms of chokeholds. So you see action, concrete action. But the problem is so deep that these actions by themselves will not transform neither the police department alone nor the overall system of anti-Black racism. So the real question for me is that can we take this, what I call fragile coalition, wobbly bridging between all the different groups and turn it into something institutional and sustainable? And it's too early to say. I think we see signs of that, and there's a hope of that, but it's too early to say. The other thing that's very different, of course, is that Johnson, even though he was a supporter of civil rights and a reluctant supporter of the Kerner Commission, was a supporter. Today, we have in the White House someone who's extremely hostile. So if you want to think about the top of our political branch at the federal level and the Republican Party themselves are clearly aligned against racial justice, although there's starting to be a crack in that opposition in the Republican Party and certainly in the establishment. So they're mixed signals, but I think it's too soon to tell. And I think it depends on if we can maintain the pressure and if we can institutionalize some of the reforms and changes that people are asking for.
Sandra Susan Smith, I was struck by the fact that in the years leading up to the Kerner Commission report, you know, three pieces of significant legislation that were trying to battle racism in the country, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the Federal Housing Act of 1968. Oh, actually, sorry, the first two, and then the Federal Housing Act of 1968 was after the Kerner Commission. But those two things, legislation that was meaningful, hard fought, hard won, obviously did not translate into the day-to-day experience of Black and African-American people in the United States. What do you think it will take to translate into meaningful on-the-ground daily life experience change that is going to be measurable and meaningful?
Yeah. I mean, I think that is the question, right? I mean, this is in part why it's not quite clear how much hope we should, I think, have in this moment. I appreciated all of the comments that John made. And, but one of the things that occurred to me about what is different or special about this moment is that so many of us have been sheltered in place or at home. There's no job to go to, et cetera. So we're sitting here watching all of this happen. What's different from now and what has taken place in protests, even very recent protests, is that, you know, you have the attention of the American people because so many people are out of work. We're sitting here, we're watching this. We've seen acts of you know, basically police terror. We have seen Black men running from police and being shot in the back. We've seen all of these images before and it hasn't produced this. It strikes me that what makes this moment different in part is that there's a captive audience. You have in the US and across the globe, people who are kind of sitting there watching because there's there's not that much else to do. And so there's this moment where you can take it in. And my question then becomes, what happens when the economy fully opens and people get back to their daily lives and they're taken up with work and the bills and all the other, and raising the children and all the other things that they do? Will the tension on these issues be sustained over that period of time? And I'm just not convinced that that is the case. And I think that that is one of the things that makes this moment so different from prior moments, is that there is this captive audience. One of the things that I have been thinking a lot about is what would make this moment different. What there are, you know, so many people, multiracial masses of people protesting. We have folks who have not in the past been convinced that there's systemic racism, and now they seem to be, and they seem to be committed to some change at least. How do we take that and move towards not just kind of a few policy reforms here and there, but dismantling institutions of racial domination? And I think that's, it's no less than that we need. In the past, what we have had are these policy shifts that would, you know, change some relationships in some ways, but not fundamentally dismantle the kinds of institutional policies and procedures that allow for the reproduction of inequality on the ground in the lives of people.
Or incentivize them.
Exactly. I appreciate many of the conversations that are being had. I think conversations about defunding are much more appropriate for this moment. It strikes me that even more than that might be needed, but it is a good start to this conversation. The issue, of course, is that there's just a lot of cleavage around this issue. So many people find the police to be such an important. How could you live without police? How do you survive and are protected by the police? And so I suspect many folks in the Black community will find the idea of dismantling the police and defunding them in these ways to be deeply problematic. There has to be a kind of consensus around moving in this direction, or enough of one so that you can actually not just move funds from one year to the next. So for instance, I don't think much of what Garcetti is proposing, $150 million when your budget is $2 billion, doesn't mean a lot to me and could easily be replaced in the next year or two. How do you move in such a way that the police are actively doing far less, and we empower different kinds of agents who can really provide resources, and to have that sustained over the long term, and to transform those other services? You know, social workers are not, you know, I don't know of a lot of my friends and family members from low-income Black communities who go around celebrating social workers. They are problematic too. Lots of institutions have to be reformed. And so I think we can talk about what's happened with regards to the police, but we also have to recognize that is just one part of a larger system of racial domination that we have to deal with. In dealing with that institution, we also have to then address the other institutions that in some ways parallel the kinds of oppressive behaviors that we've seen. I think that this is just, this is a long haul. I don't think we can expect that there's much that's going to be done this summer, this year, perhaps even this decade. I really think that we have to be thinking in terms of a multi-decade kind of struggle to fundamentally dismantle these institutions of racial domination and rebuild. If we think anything short of that, we can expect continued gaps between, you know, whites and other and people of color, generally speaking, to continue. And we can also expect to see the kinds of exploitative, oppressive, brutal acts by agents of various state organizations. I will leave it there.
Well, it just makes me think that can there be a series of early wins that will help sustain the momentum? I'm going to leave that as a rhetorical question for a moment while I reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and you can join our conversation tonight about the Kerner Report and what it means for the struggles for racial justice in this current day by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can find us on Twitter. We're at cityvisionskalw. So, John Powell, I wanted to ask you a follow-up to that point I made. What could look like some small wins that could be meaningful? Do you see some things already coalescing? Your microphone is muted.
You know, as was Yogi Berra's famous statement, it was like, it's hard to make predictions, especially when it's about the future. I think it's really too early to say. Things happen very slowly, and then things happen very fast. And it's not clear, even before the uprisings in response to the killing of George Floyd, a lot of people were sort of seeing the pandemic, and we're facing multiple pandemics, at least two, if not three. We're talking about really radical change. In some ways, we could say Trump's election was a radical change. So change doesn't always happen slowly. Nor do we have to do everything, because things are interrelated. Sometimes that interrelation keeps things in place, but sometimes it means you can hit what in systems theory is called leverage points, and it populates across the whole system. And I think the will that you made reference to earlier, that Alan made reference to in terms of King, it may be there. There may be something happening. And again, it's hard to read how things will play out. A friend of mine wrote a book called The Wages of Whiteness, and I playing off, this is David Roediger, playing off the words of W.E.B. Du Bois, and I wrote him, he should write a new book called The Declining Wages of Whiteness, because what the things associated with whiteness is actually in decline. Can something else take a place? We are shifting from a neoliberal society, which is not good, to a neo-fascist society. But also, there are remnants of a progressive society that's really multiracial and where we can live in with a kind of equality and justice that we can only have dreamed of. So I think everything's up for grabs. We're at a huge inflection point. And what I can say without any hesitation, though, is that where we are now is different. Which is different than the question of where we will be next. Yeah. And whether these small wins can turn into large victories. I worked on anti-apartheid in the frontline states. I did postgraduate work in Africa, and I was in Africa doing that work and doing those studies when Steve Biko was killed in prison in South African jails. And I was more than just a casual observer. I was doing postgraduate work. I was working with activists and people on the ground. And my assessment when Biko died or was killed was that South Africa and Southern Africa probably would not be liberated in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. And 4 years later or thereabouts, I'm having dinner in the house of Nelson Mandela. I didn't see it coming. Change does not always happen incrementally. And I think part of the thing, you know, frankly, because we've had so many false efforts, aborted efforts in the United States on racial justice, it's hard to believe that we can actually ever crack this. I think we can, but I'm not optimistic, but neither am I pessimistic. But I do think there's an opportunity, and I think we need to grab this opportunity and run with it as hard as we can, as smart as we can. You know, there were a number of police that killed Black people that weren't even charged, that didn't lose their jobs. Or there was a protracted studies like we're going to have some sort of investigation. We're going to look at all the evidence. We don't know what happened, even if there's a tape involved. These guys were fired within a day. the first, Derek, the guy who had his neck on George Floyd's neck, was charged within a couple of days. The charge was enhanced again in a couple of days still. I mean, this is actually significant. How significant? I don't know. And it mattered that Keith Ellison, who's a friend of mine, first Muslim to serve in Congress, as Attorney General. Some things are worse. I mean, Alan talked about it. The criminal justice system, the rate of incarceration is much worse today than it was when the 1967 riots and uprisings were happening in the United States. On the other hand, we just saw 1.4 million people enfranchised in Florida, the largest enfranchisement since 1920. What would this mean? We don't know, but it means something. So I think there's almost a tendency too often, especially on the left, to diminish any victory we do have. And on the right, there's maybe a tendency to exaggerate the victory. I think we just can't know, but this moment, this time is different. How can we build something to make it lasting, real, and serious? Again, we're already starting to ask those questions in the context of the pandemic. This has added fuel to that. So I think we need to sort of take advantage of those without needing to know with any degree of certainty where it's going to land.
Alan Curtis, I wanted to go back to you for a moment, given that you've studied the Kerner Commission's report so much. Do you think that the events of the last few weeks, packaged with a lot of the insights that people have gained over the last few months of the pandemic and its disproportionate impact on Black and brown people, do you think people are going to be convinced? Do you think another commission is going to be necessary? It seems like the Kerner Commission had it spot on 50 years ago, but yet today we heard from Congressman Barbara Lee's office that she might try to launch a new commission. I wonder, is it going to delay the process if we have to pause to study this some more?
I don't think a new commission is necessary. I think it's really important to worry about getting back to normal, quote unquote. Normal is the problem. And that's why John is really right, saying we need to seize the day, carpe diem. We need to keep going the kind of energy that we see all over the country in these 750 events. So that builds, for example, on Reverend Barber's June 20th conference in Washington, in which the Poor People's Campaign is continuing on with the notion of creating new will. So we really have to, I think, be happy about the various constituencies coming together through Black Lives Matter. And we can make small or not so small immediate gains, I think, for example, in voter registration, because whether or not we do small or large things is going to depend in part on who wins the election, obviously. And I would also say that as we look then and now, we really can see evidence of what works. And while the broad theme that we're talking about and the most important theme in America now is changing the culture of racism, there are specific policies and programs which we should at least keep in the debate and the dialogue as we try to seize the day and really renegotiate the social contract and the rules of the game. I mean, for example, we need Keynesian demand-side policy that generates jobs for middle-class and working-class and poor people in rehabbing the rotting infrastructure. We don't need supply-side tax breaks for the rich. We need greater school equity in the education realm. We don't need vouchers and privatization. We need, in some cases, really good, genuine community-based policing, which you've done, for example, in a great program in the Bayview neighborhood of San Francisco. We don't need zero tolerance policing and stop and frisk. So those policies, education, employment, public safety, public health, and criminal justice policies, they all intertwine. And to keep the discussion going, I think we have to de-silo the policy debate and talk about multiple solutions. And maybe that's too jargony, but the concrete solutions based on evidence needs to complement the overall movement for racial justice.
So, Sandra Susan Smith, I wanted to go back to this idea of the multi-ethnic, multi-racial presence on the streets. It seems like people are getting it. But when it comes to sacrifices or changes to the social structure that they may need to contribute to make these shifts happen, how does that jump happen? You know, what if it means higher taxes? What if it means other policies that suddenly, you know, take away privileges or rebalance the way opportunity is meted out? How does that conversation happen? And how do you sustain the attention of people who may see that they maybe have something to lose by this rebalancing?
I think it's a great question, Joseph. It's hard to imagine, and we don't even have to speak in racial terms. It's hard to imagine any privileged folks being willing to give up their privilege, which provides them access with all sorts of, you know, society's valued resources. The privileged work hard to hoard opportunities so that they can, you know, enjoy their own lives and pass it on to their children. I'm having a difficult time imagining what that would look like to be able to be willing to cede the ground, to be willing to change the rules so that you don't have this kind of advantage going into almost every realm of society. So I think in that way, I'm probably the pessimistic liberal that John mentioned earlier. It's a difficult thing for me to imagine, given that, you know, culturally speaking, I think in the U.S., we do have a kind of winner-take-all mentality. And so I need to do things in such a way that I get access, and that will mean other people don't. You know, we raise our kids in ways that make it so that they are heaped with advantage in ways that disadvantage others. And we are okay with that because it positions our children well. And it's not like we want to do bad things to other children or to disadvantage them in this way. But if one child has to win, it's going to be mine. And I'm going to do whatever I can to make that happen. And we see that happening in multiple realms or domains of life. I don't see how individual whites will make decisions about their lives that will fundamentally alter that. Not in any huge numbers, to be honest. And it's hard to see how they would support policies or the practices of institutions in ways that will truly level the playing field. And by that, I mean, it's not just that you make decisions at the moment about who you're going to hire, but that you fundamentally change how you provide resources to various communities so that from the start of life, different individuals have access to the kinds of resources that will make it so that they can thrive as human beings. To the extent that people think that that's going to negatively affect them and make it so that they're less able to compete, I think it's going to shut down conversations pretty quickly. And, you know, I think this, to the extent that this moment might be different in some ways, I actually think we should, history cautions us to not be overly optimistic. We have been in this moment before. The Kerner Commission was not the first of its kind in the 20th century. It was probably the fourth or fifth document of its kind in the 20th century to be written, and providing very similar prescriptions. We know what we need to do in order to make things, in order to change things for the better. We have known for at least 100 years. And every time there's no will, because it would mean something in terms of redistributing resources in important ways, We should be reminded, and you know, everyone knows this, slavery moves to Jim Crow. Jim Crow moves to the ghettos of the North and Midwest, and we move from that to mass incarceration. Even if there is some measure of progress here, we should be ready for the next form that racial domination, institutions of racial domination will take, because there's always a backlash to any kind of progress that's made. And so I'm very much attuned to that. I would love to see us move forward in a substantial way. I don't think small reforms will get us there, but I also think we should be ready for the backlash that always comes when there is any move forward. And I think we should be very careful about how we make sense of this moment too. I mean, because even during the period of the civil rights movement or the aftermath, we were thinking about the ways in which the numbers of Blacks and Latinos in institutions of higher education were growing. You had people taking on middle-class jobs, et cetera, mostly in the public sector, not so much in the private, but there's progress to be made. All the time that was happening, concentrated poverty was increasing in Black communities across the country, and especially in the Northeast and Midwest. Social services were declining, including I'm losing my train of thought here. Social services are declining. Let me just add the final point. And we see the increase in the number of people who are arrested and imprisoned. Now, if we were to, we have celebrate often how much progress it is that we've made Blacks relative to whites in this country. But what we now know to be true is that much of that progress can be explained away by the fact that we have warehoused essentially a huge percentage of the people who are at the bottom rung. They don't get included in our stats, which means the levels of progress it seems that we've made gets overestimated, because we're not taking into consideration that we are warehousing lots of people who lack education, lack employment, et cetera. We put them back into our stats, and what we know to be true is that we've not made anywhere near as much progress as we think we've made. So you do have people like me in the positions that I hold, but what this does is obscure the fact that we have a lot of people who are still suffering and who don't have access to opportunities for mobility. And so I think that we should keep those pictures in our head as we have these kinds of conversations.
There's so much more to talk about. We have like a minute left. John Powell, I want to ask you to be brief with two questions. The first is, how is the media going to help influence how this moves forward, specifically social media?
So you want to ask both questions, or you want me to respond to that?
Just respond. Oh, the second one is, what does Biden have to do to really make people believe in him, that they should come out to vote for him in November?
Well, I think the media, so here's the thing. There are multiple stories, and I know all the data that Sandra actually cited, and I think there are pieces of it that are left out. For example, after the New Deal, Blacks actually, even though they left out of New Deal, and from 1950 to 1970, the Black-white gap actually shrunk. Mass incarceration actually became a reality in the late 1960s, early 70s, and we had problems. And so this history is not evenly all bad or good. In the stories we tell and the stories we believe is actually quite important. And one of the things a lot of data shows is that Blacks are not only declining in relationship to whites, the whites are declining in relationship to the elites. So there's new possibilities. So I think telling that story, there was actually what people would some call the Great Compression, where equality was growing in the United States from about 1945 to 1970. So I think telling stories which energize people, telling stories which allow people to sort of see their face length, is one of the things that social media and the media in general have to do. I think in terms of Biden, I think who he picks as vice president will be important. I think he has to energize the young community. And most researchers say if the Black voters, if 66% of Black people are eligible to vote, the Democrats win. It dropped in 2016 to about 64. If Biden can get it up to 66, Black voters matter a lot. In fact, Black voters, especially Black women, overwhelmingly vote Democratic. And I think Biden needs to actually, I think, focus on Black women, Black people generally, and young people. And then I think, you know, I'd like to see him have someone help him with some of his talking points, as well as some of his policies. He needs to surround himself. You know, he comes from a very moderate perspective. The country's move, the Democratic Party's moved to the left as well.
All right. Well, I really want to thank my guests in this segment, Sandra Susan Smith, formerly of UC Berkeley, heading towards Harvard, John A. Powell, staying at UC Berkeley, and Alan Curtis of the Eisenhower Foundation for a very dynamic and rich conversation. We have to have you back because there's so much more to talk about.
Thank you, Joseph.
I want to thank the rest of you for listening and tuning in this evening. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. I want to thank tonight's engineer, David LaTulipe. Tonight's show is produced by Grace Wong and Wendy Holcomb. And next week, we move to a new time slot, Monday at 6 p.m. So don't forget to set your calendar on your iPhone or other mobile device to ring at 6 p.m. next Monday for the next edition of City Visions. For all of us here, I'm Joseph Pache. Thanks. Good night. Have a great week.